Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Hello, 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 everybody. Hey, Paul.
I think they heard me say, here we go.
Here we go? Here we go. Were you doing some Whitesnake? Is that what you're doing?
A Whitesnake. You always have to have some bizarre cultural reference here. Go Google Whitesnake from the 80s here if you don't know what to.
Here I go again. I know. Actually, that could be a good... It's always been a favorite song of mine. Maybe we should start using that as a song for the
show.
We
could do that.
Here we go again. I know you guys don't really want to listen to us, but here we are again.
And I was friends, or at least friends with his friend, Steve Vai, who was the guitarist for Whitesnake, so you, and then David Lee Roth.
So I say Whitesnake, and you got to up me and say I'm 2 degrees of separation from the guitarist.
I'm closer than you are.
It was the top MTV video of its year.
Yeah, I know. Was. No, I used to have that on my cell phone. I don't know why I would have it on my cell phone.
That,
it's like this, the Angry Years or something.
And there was a woman who was sort of a hot model for a short period of time. She was in Bachelor Party with Tom Hanks, one of his early movies that didn't
Oh,
get
my
attention.
God.
And
dust
she,
the dirt on that one.
And then she was in that video, and then I forgot her name now, and then she ended up marrying some big baseball player here and from the Anaheim. And there was all sorts of controversy because they had a big, ugly divorce and all this.
See, ladies and gentlemen, you tune it's into the Rad Life.
It's all connected.
And you turn,
it's all one big thread.
You tune into the Rad Life. Ignore it, Paul, over there. Okay. And the nuggets that you pick up, right, that are only usable on old episodes of Jeopardy, okay, are just a plethora of them here. Right? But listen, it's nice to have a little bit something different to talk about, right?
Yes.
Than just, you know, I'm stressed out.
I'm glad we're not talking about anything to do with elections today.
Very funny.
Why would we want
well, you know what? I'm going to introduce my guest, but then I want a moment on the soapbox.
Okay.
This, today.
Okay? All right.
My guest is my buddy, my friend, Dr. Jose F. Moreno, because we don't want to mistake him with somebody right. else who questionably is also running on the periphery of his District 3 in Anaheim, where he's running for city council. But other than running for city council, okay, he's also president of Los Amigos in Anaheim. He is professor of Chicano Latino Studies at Cal State Long Beach. And the list goes on and on and on. I mean, I just gave up after the three. I stopped reading, right?
Father of four beautiful girls and
Harvard Review.
Married to an amazing school principal.
Unbelievable, yes. Right. Whatever. Your wife is amazing. And active, involved. I mean, you know, and we'll get into that a little bit more, right? But this is the stuff, personalities like Jose, people like that, that are out there and being of service. This is really what it's all about, right? This is the fabric of our communities, the diversity that makes us really strong. Okay, as a country and as our local communities. And I wanted to just, I started off this morning, I told these guys in the studio, I said, I started off this morning, I kind of needed my moment of venting.
Yes.
Okay? And I basically...
Should we just leave the studio for a while?
No, it'll be really fast. Okay? So, in case you don't know, okay, we are 13 days away from E-Day.
E-Day, what happens in 13 days? Let's see, the World Series? No,
well, according to Donald Trump, it's the 28th, not the 13th, so
yeah,
it's a little longer. It's basically the day of election
yes.
day, presidential elections. So I wrote the following, and I'll just share this, and then we're going to get back to the show.
Didn't we decide that already? Hasn't it already been figured out that he's lost?
We are 13 days away from E-Day,
out.
Paul, right?
All right?
And looking back at this drawn-out, at times seeming like it would never end, 2 years of electioneering. Many of us may even be suffering a form of PESD, prolonged electioneering stress disorder.
That's the truth.
Okay? All of which has some of us not only stressed out, but also resentful and entrenched perhaps more than we would ever be in our regular lives. Okay? Anchored in. Finding ourselves reacting more and more impulsively, tapping into our fight or flight responses.
Boy, that's it. That is it. Say that again. Our fight or flight.
We either want
to fight with the other side, or we just want to run away.
Yeah. Finding ourselves mentally drained and fatigued by 2 years of seeming constant political barraging 24/7.
Almost none of which had to do with issues. All of it had to do with personalities.
No issues. Okay. Putting up barriers and barricading ourselves from doing any further exploring and discovering about candidates or issues. Simply framing the campaigns with sound bites like, Donald Trump is going to destroy America, or Hillary is corrupt. But it is just at this exact moment and place that we need to exercise vigilance, pushing our minds to think beyond those initial barriers, beyond the laziness of hate. It is this time that we need to say a loud no to politicians or their surrogates who use fear to breed hate to drive their message. It is the lazy way to galvanize support, a way to appeal to primitive parts of the brain to scare a voter. Yes, building a campaign through collaboration, empathy, and compassion takes a lot of effort, but it's the only effort that deserves taking. When messages of hate take control, intellectual laziness prevents us from digging deeper to really try to see the other side. If these 2 years of politicking and bombardment of bravado have shown us anything at all, it is that relationship building and bridging and collaboration is sorely missing and very much needed in our governmental agencies, locally, regionally, as well as nationally. True leadership today requires swallowing pride and putting forth a good deal of effort to work towards the united common goodness of our communities, and to do so in a sustainable way. To do the job elected to, and not make it your job to simply get re-elected. Hate mongering is easy, and believing it is lazy, and healthy minds should be very leery of messages that are trying to poke us where we are most susceptible, in our fears and apprehensions. Instead, true leadership should be encouraging our engagement and championing our common aspirations. So, stay strong, stay engaged, stay leery of those who are in the 11th hour will probably amplify the use of hate and separating us to a feverish pitch and only be seeking selfish achievement of elected status, okay, regardless of who they leave strewn into the battlefield of personality political warfare. With that note,
standing note from the audience here.
Yeah, a lovely audience.
You know how I feel about that, though? You know what my feeling is when I hear that? I hate it.
No, fine. You hate it? That's pretty funny.
You hated the reading, the reader, or the...
He just hates it all.
Politics.
I hate it all. Hate everything. So, hate is so easy. I love that. I'll tell you what I did like was the laziness of hate. I never thought that way. Hate is an easy, lazy response. I don't have to get to know you. I just hate you. I hate you.
Right. And this is why...
Done. I've written you off. I don't have to know anything more about you.
And this is why, okay... We are here to talk about this today, okay? Because whether it's fear, whether it's economic conditions, whether whatever it is, okay, we seem to be in a fevered pitch where people are not looking at what brings them together, but just little isolation islands of this and that and so forth, right? And perfect example, okay, and I'll lead with this, Jose, okay, because what happened in the case of Anaheim, and it seems to be something that's not limited to Anaheim. From what I read, it's actually something that's happening everywhere. Okay, people feel disenfranchised. In this case of Anaheim, there was an actual lawsuit threat from the ACLU relevant to the fact that there was not enough representation, am I correct, to the ethnic mix of the community and on the city council, and that needed to be rectified. And there was a call for districting. There was a fight against it. There was a push by the people. There were multiple maps. There was task force. There was community involvement at length, right? And finally, the decision was made by the current city council to actually allow for districting, which caused, I mean, there's 20 candidates running. Isn't there 20 something like 20 candidates running for election this year?
There's four districts, and yeah, it'd probably be about 20. I think there's seven in District 1, there's five in District 3, three in District 4. Where are we at? That's 15.
15. Yeah.
So, yeah, and then five. Yeah, five in
so
District
about 20
four,
people.
Four in District 5, so
yeah.
About 19.
And about 19 or 20 people.
So
what that says, to me, is that there are people that are frustrated.
Oh, well,
right?
That's the one message that comes
and
left and right.
That has echoed through this election, presidential election as well. People are frustrated, whether it be Bernie supporters or Trump supporters or what have you, right? Or the fear of one candidate versus the other. But what has been sacrificed in the course of all of this is the conversation you pointed out to, Paul, the substance, the policies.
Very little of that.
The how do we work together for a better tomorrow as a community, as a country, right? And so... I was just at a candidates forum a couple of days ago, and Jose was one of the candidates that was speaking. And it was the thing that amazed me the most. I mean, the oratory was beautiful, but what amazed me the most was really that the room was full of 17-year-olds,
That's unusual.
They're not even of election of voting age, but they were in that room.
Yeah. Actually, it's 14, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds.
Thank you. But they were. It my was, point is, they were under
listening
18.
To a candidate.
Why, yes, why,
that never
yes.
happens.
No, to a forum of candidates.
Wow.
Yeah.
11.
So
we had 11.
How do you explain that? What was it? Was it at a school? Were they forced to do this for civics class or whatever they call it these days? Or?
So what do you? I mean, you, I know you've been involved. You've been involved through Los Amigos. You've been involved, you know, with equality and ethnic representation and Latino issues for a while. So from your perspective. Have things just organically led to this? Is it because we have not done enough? What does the future look like for us? I mean, this is a county, Orange County, that has changed.
How do we come together after this? After we've screamed at each other this loud,
is it even possible?
How are we going to work? Whoever gets elected to any of these positions, how are you all going to work together? You're running for city council.
Right.
So, what district are you running in?
District 3.
Okay.
It's the central north district of Anaheim.
Is there a geographical boundary?
So, right. So it's nestled right in between Euclid and East Street, and then the 91 freeway to the north, and pretty much South Street to the south.
Now, would it be fair to say that was the area in... I don't know how to say this politely, but there was a lot of racial tension in that area a while ago. There were some mini little riots on the news and stuff here. People got very upset over some, I guess, police actions. I don't remember exactly what happened, but within the last year or two, there was a lot of racial tension. Is that the area?
Yeah, yes, but it's not just confined to the area. It's really, and they were... It was in 2012 where we saw it
flare up.
Just really blow up.
Right.
And then that year, there were, I think, eight young men who were killed by the police, mm-hmm. Officer-involved killings. And there were two in one weekend, and that's just what really, with one of them being, the guy was running, Manuel Diaz was running, and they shot him in the back. And that's what really flared everything up, because the police then showed up, and people were saying, why did you just shoot him in the back? And he was still alive, from most accounts, and they seemed to take their time in calling the paramedics. And that's what got the community really just like, look, this is way over the top. And then the police came in and came in pretty rough. A police dog escaped or was let go and attacked residents, and it just really blew up. But, yeah, this is the part of Anaheim, but really all of Anaheim outside of the resort area is struggling. And what that really did was it just was the spark that got the news media, to be honest with you, to pay attention to what's happening in Anaheim.
And let me just get a couple demographic facts out. Isn't Anaheim the largest city in Orange County, or is it Irvine bigger? I don't know which one's the biggest city population-wise or size-wise.
I believe it's either Santa Ana or Anaheim.
I would think it would be one of those two.
Anaheim has 350,000 plus people, one of the top 10 cities in the
and
state.
And what we've had the – we do a public policy show here brought to you by the Association of California Cities. We've had the mayors. We haven't had the mayor in from Anaheim, but we've had the police chief, I know, and the fire chief in here. And I don't know what the racial makeup of the department is in those cities. Is it still overwhelmingly white? Have we moved past it? Because I know community policing from the 70s or 80s or whatever, this whole idea of getting people to reflect the community they work in and to be involved in the community they work in has been a pretty successful idea where it's been implemented.
But Anaheim is actually larger than Santa Ana.
Yeah, I thought it was.
So it's the largest
city. So what, I don't know, do we know what the, when you say the police came in, so do I picture a bunch of white cops coming into a Hispanic neighborhood here? Or is it more reflective of the community?
I think what folks have begun to really bring more to our conscience is that your ethnic background, racial background may matter, only out of the belief that one's lived experience can and should inform how you interact and interrelate with people.
Right. You don't see them as them.
Right. But there is a training that people go through. And so that creates a different kind of cultural view to the world. And in Anaheim...
To be a cop, right?
Right. To be a cop and how you see community. So it is about how officers are trained. It is about how we recruit them. And it is about the kind of resources we provide for them to truly be able to become the traditional community police officer, which is someone who walks the street, yeah, who gets to know walking, the neighborhood.
Right, walking the beat, know right. who's good, know who's bad.
That's right, right. That people can trust. And we just don't see that to the extent. There's a lot of, it's become a buzzword, community policing, but you just don't see that in Anaheim or larger cities, at least here in Orange County, where people actually know their police officers.
And there's another side of police, community policing that people don't discuss enough, and that is if the police truly embed themselves and get to know the community and react out of respect and restraint and all those kinds of things and still do their job, that the community in turn will respond and say, hey, there's the bad guy. He went that away. Rather than, I know in some communities, particularly poor communities, police have a tendency to say, gee, everybody, nobody wants to talk, nobody wants to say anything, everybody just scatters. So,
well, let me just
either because they're afraid of gangs or retaliation.
I just want to be clear, we're not picking necessarily on the police per se or specifically Anaheim, because I think this particular issue is common in a lot of places across the country.
It seems to have flared. I guess what right. I'm trying to dig at, it's all across the country.
But there is another factor I think that doesn't get talked about much, is that the cost. In many cases, it used to be traditionally that every community had its own police force, rather than have a regional police force or a county force that basically was contracted out to.
Right.
So in many cases, you had people that lived in the community that also were part of that police force. So my neighbor, the yes. cop, is somebody I knew who also knew me. Now, to be fair to both sides, there's a disconnect. Okay, so when people are not necessarily living in Anaheim, but they are policing in Anaheim, okay, to you have to go that extra step to build that bridge.
That too.
Otherwise, you don't have that connection. It may say protect and serve on the side of the car, but you can't really do it from the other side of a bulletproof window.
And there's been a big
only
just to set the stage for this discussion in Orange County here. We've done a number of issues. We've had the sheriff in here, Sandra Hutchins, and the assistant sheriff, and others. There are quite a number of cities. Anaheim's not one of them that are contract out to the sheriff's department rather than have their own police department.
So is it actually Anaheim police?
No, it is Anaheim PD. It is contract. And it is our own police department.
So are those correct. Officers actually part of it? They live in the neighborhoods.
That's a great question. It's a question that several of us have asked, and there's been some pushback, which is how do we incentivize and or maybe provide an advantage in the recruitment mm-hmm. process or hiring process to folks who actually either grew up in the city and now live in the city, who then want to serve the city.
There have been one or two cities that have tried that where they'll actually give you a subsidy for housing if you choose to live in some community. I'm trying to remember Montebello
right.
or something.
But it's true across our public institutions. In
right.
education, where
right.
we talk about the same thing,
right.
about do the teachers live in the very spaces where their kids
right.
are, or
right.
at least in the same city? Do firefighters live in the city that they're protecting as well? So it's really about public service. Do those who serve the city live in the city that allow them to understand the true needs
and,
of the city?
And thank you for picking that up, because that's where I was going with this. We start off with the policing, but I want to transition to this, that this is an issue that I think is faced by a lot of communities, okay? Due to cost of increase in real estate pricing, housing costs, what have you, you know, we are losing out on people that are born and raised in that community being able to be of service to that community because the infrastructure is not there for them to be able to afford to live there. It's happening in affluent areas like down where I am in San Clemente, where the people that are born and raised went to that high school, multi-generational communities, where people – it used to be – we've said this before on this show. Mm-hmm. The joke used – or the normal routine was that the elderly would move to the desert.
Yes,
it's
right.
now the millennials that are moving to the desert because they cannot afford to live here. And what we
right.
lose as communities is that
connection.
Thread of connection that permeates and causes trouble all over.
Then on the other side,
schooling, policing, fire, just even entrepreneurship, future
right.
leadership, volunteer involvement.
Then on the other side you have, and I'm going to assume, I don't really know this district, but I'm going to assume it's a poorer part of Anaheim.
So that's really, you know, just go back to where you're going. So what came to light in 2012 is what many people have been saying for years and years and decades. There was a push in the early 1990s, late 80s, for district elections in Anaheim.
Mm-hmm.
There was already a clear recognition by Amin David and other folks in Los Amigos at that time and other communities who said, the city's growing and it's becoming more diverse and we just don't see the voices and the perspectives reflected on the city council.
Right.
And that wasn't only on racial ethnic terms. It was also on geographic terms. It was on economic terms. It was on perspectives of how long you've been in the city. Mm-hmm. So that push was made, and there was actually a city council vote in 1992, I believe, and it was voted down 3-2 with the current assemblyman, Tom Daley, voting against it. He voted against going to districts in 1992, which would have been quite a courageous and visionary step to take that might have precluded and prevented a lot of these ills. Where 2012 becomes the marker for us, it was also the same year that we actually did file a lawsuit against the city of Anaheim, represented by the ACLU, three of us, Amin, David, Consuelo Garcia, a teacher, and myself. And here's the interesting piece. Mm-hmm. Amin was a registered Democrat. He passed away in May.
This year.
Yeah. You know, longtime leader, what we call our Cesar Chavez of Orange County, or maybe Cesar Chavez was there, I mean, David. and Consuelo Garcia, Republican, and at the time I was a registered declined to state. So you had three people from across the political spectrum saying something's not right. And we filed a lawsuit, but not much attention was given to the lawsuit at that time, and we filed it under the California Voting Rights Act because we had data that clearly showed that there is what's called racially polarized voting in Anaheim. Mm-hmm. That is, and this is not to say that any one group is bad or whatnot, but we are who we are as human beings.
Right.
We tend to go with what is common or familiar to us. Mm-hmm. So
we're tribal.
Not necessarily tribal, we just go with what we know, right? And so if you have grown up in a segregated environment, if you're a white, if you grew up white in Anaheim, you may not have come across many Mexican Americans. You may not have come across Asian Americans or others. If you're Mexican American, you may not have come across whites. And if you moved into the city from a segregated space. So what racially polarized voting showed is that Anglos tend to vote for candidates that have Anglo names. Mm-hmm. If they know nothing else, and political science research has shown this, if you know nothing else about a candidate, you tend to go with that name that sounds familiar to you.
Mm-hmm.
If your last name is Smith, you're going to go with the last name that says Jones.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a Smith and a Garcia on the ballot, and your last name is Ramirez, you don't know anything about the two candidates, you tend to go Garcia. So Latinos tend to vote for Latino surnames, whites for white names, Anglo names.
Can I add to that?
And just Asians for Asian names.
Can
right?
I just add an interesting fact to that? I've pointed this out on the show as an old political science major here, and somebody fascinated with elections. And since America was founded as an English colony, every president but four has had, of the 40-some presidents we've had, all but four have had an English or an Irish name to them. The two Roosevelts, which are Dutch names, which is okay because there was a Dutch, the Dutch founded New York, so there's a real Dutch connection there. Van Buren, who is a Dutch name, so we've had three Dutchmen, and one German, ironically Eisenhower, who fought the war against the Germans. Mm-hmm. We've never had a French or a Spanish or any other even European name, much less the exception being, the fifth one being, obviously, Obama, which I tend to think of, because he's half Irish, as O apostrophe Obama. He's still Irish. But even on that level, on that national level, we still think of ourselves as a white English colony to some extent.
We do. So, but coming back home.
Yes, right.
Is that was what initiated this, and the data was pretty clear. And the city, for whatever reason, well, we know its reasons. It wanted to keep its status quo.
Mm-hmm. The current power structure wants to stay in power.
Spent $3 million of taxpayer money resisting
that change. The city spent the money.
Right, because the lawsuit they had to defend, and they contracted private attorneys, a firm, and just to fight this, right? And this was strictly about voting, franchising voters.
Mm-hmm.
We were willing to say, look, if you want to put it to a vote, put it to a vote. Now, our concern was if you put it to a vote, then you're putting civil rights for a vote. That's something that just doesn't feel right.
Yeah, that's true.
But we did say to the city, if you want to put it for a vote and voters want to vote it in, great, then the lawsuit's moot. They chose not to. They chose to fight it for 2 years. And here's the interesting fact that most folks don't know is they offered a settlement. Once the judge agreed to go to trial, they offered the settlement after we sent a deposition list. The deposition list of witnesses that we were seeking to interview for the lawsuit included two presidents of Disney, one past, one present, the previous mayor of Anaheim, now a huge corporate lobbyist, Kurt Pringle, and the five council members, including the mayor. And when you depose somebody in these kind of cases, you can, the parameters become quite broad about when and what did you know, when did you know it, and who did you know it with?
Right.
Because we knew that the levers of the city council are not of their own making. They are controlled by the monies that finance them. And we know that district elections, which is what was exciting to us, while it was initiated as a civil rights issue around the California Voting Rights Act, which, again, doesn't say you have to vote you have to vote in Latinos. It's that the Latino electorate is 32% of the city.
Mm-hmm.
The Anglo electorate is 40% of the city. Those are the two major ethnic groups. If racially polarized voting is happening, which our data showed it was, even if all Latinos voted and all Anglos voted, the likelihood that Anglos get to always choose the candidate of their choice
mm-hmm.
is always there, and Latinos would not get their candidate of choice. Even if they wanted to vote for an O'Hara or a Smith, they will not get the candidate of choice unless it's something that Anglos wanted. And that's what violated
civil rights. So let me ask you again.
Having elections at large versus
having elections at large. Thank you.
So let me ask. I'm not trying to be provocative here, but we get
why not? Let's provoke.
Wearing cargo pants.
We have this. I'm already provocative. We had, again, this Association of California Cities had this other show, and they talked a little bit about this issue. And recognizing that most people who came in were probably from the white Anglo establishment that, were against this. And their argument, because we had the same issue in Capistrano School District, and it wasn't so much racial, it was there were a bunch of rich people from a handful of areas that were winning all the elections, that were running and winning all the elections. Was the money being fairly spread out among all the schools in Capistrano, which is all pretty an affluent area? There's not really poor schools, I don't think, in the whole Capistrano.
Let me set a timestamp for that. That's almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And we go through this relevant to that particular school district almost every election cycle, including the current one.
Yes.
Okay.
So the idea
was... So that's
how
entrenched some of those special... I don't even want to call them special interests because it's almost like...
People
with a certain thought of how things should be.
Right.
That happen to have the levers
somehow
accessible
they come to
them.
Dominate the elections.
Right.
And so this wasn't even racial. It was just people from a certain... You were getting candidates who all lived in the same city.
It was regional. Yeah.
And the argument for that is obvious. You're going to get more diverse voices. The whole district will be represented if they have a chance to choose locally and not at large. The counter-argument is this, and this is what I'm asking for your comment on. The counter-argument is the more you break a district down and the more it becomes only one group of people.
Focus on that group's interest.
You're only going to focus on that group's interest, and you become more polarized. Because theoretically, it's the same thing of a U.S. senator having to campaign in the entire state versus a local representative who carves out a district that's all something, that's all green,
so
it's all purple, all ones.
So if I'm understanding correctly, Paul, your question is, what seems to be an improvement
could be a negative.
You're putting on devil's advocate, and you're arguing that it would basically further divide.
Yes.
Right. Well,
how do you answer that?
Well, I want to avoid devil's advocates because the devil has a lot of advocates.
He doesn't need any help.
I don't think the devil needs more advocacy. But Paul, going to your point is that was what it allowed us as a legal tool to address what we saw as a just huge disenfranchisement of the people of Anaheim.
Clearly.
Right. So that tool allowed us to force the city into a conversation, if not then an action, to change the electoral system. Here's what we found out, which was really validating. In doing that kind of work, you get racialized. You get told that you just are only interested in Latinos, that you hate whites, you're anti-white.
You're
just a special interest racialist because you're Chicano studies and you're Latino. But what we found, which was really amazing, is what we knew, right? By found, I mean that the people began to talk about it, and as did the media, is... Well, lo and behold, white folks across the city of Anaheim said, yeah, we don't feel we have a voice in this city. It's owned by the resort industry. Mm-hmm. It's owned by, and the resort industry is controlled by, the Disney Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that people who want to run for office need to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to get their message to 130,000 voters across the city.
I see.
So what tends to happen is when you have at-large systems is working class, working poor people are fundamentally disenfranchised because they're working constantly. It's very hard to pay attention to the body politic.
And they can't raise enough money to run in that election.
And they cannot raise enough money. Now, you could if you agree completely with those who control the city, right? Their interest, the corporate interest. So what we found, and why it's so validating what's happening with 20 candidates across four districts, is you feel like, okay, now for me, for example, I ran in 2014 just to prove the point, right? Mm-hmm. I wanted to win, of course, but just to show and to have the experience of trying to reach 130,000 voters was absolutely impossible. Absolutely impossible. The Disney Corporation, along with its corporate partners, pulled together over $1.7 million for a city council seat. Right?
A city council seat cost $1.7 million.
Right. That's what they spent to keep it, right? And we raised about $60,000. So we tried to do what we could. In the district environment now, right, I have to reach 19,000 voters. That's what each district is about, 17,000 to 20,000 voters.
Yep.
Disney has already contributed $180,000 to $200,000 to independent expenditures as well as to the candidate, the current council member who's supported and advocated and championed corporate tax giveaways to the tune of $700 million. So in the past, nobody would take that on.
Right,
over the last 2 years. So no one would be willing to take that on because you wouldn't have the money to get your message out.
Sure.
It's a waste of time, really. So in this cycle, we know that our primary opponent has $300,000, almost $400,000 that will be spent for him or by his own committee. And we're worried about that. But we know if we have volunteers and we spend our own time and we walk and we knock on doors and we raise some money, we can get our message out to 19,000 voters, right?
That's doable.
So it's much more doable. It creates hope in people to want to, you know, I can do this. I can do this. I don't need to be sponsored by big interests.
So when you get together, though, there's five districts?
There's six districts and the mayor will remain at large.
Okay, so there's six plus seven. How do those people, now that they represent a more homogenous group of people, whatever it is, ethnically, economically, whatever.
But it's not. And I think that's the misnomer, okay? What I'm hearing is districts based on boundaries, geographic defined boundaries.
Right.
Very, very similar to wards, if you will, in New York or in Chicago. You know, that's what it is. Now, if it happens to be starting to sound like, well, it's an ethnic concentration, well, that in itself is proof of why this is actually something that should have been done. But what you refer to as being interests of a homogenous based on ethnicity, that's not how those districts were drawn up. They were drawn up by geographical boundaries.
So are they ethnically diverse? Are they economically diverse? Are there rich and poor people? Are there different groups in all these districts, or did they draw them up so?
The law does require, the California Rights Act, that you do have to provide opportunity districts so that a historically disenfranchised ethnic group will have the opportunity to elect a candidate of choice. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that the candidate has to be Latino or African American or white or a woman, just that the electorate is enfranchised, right? So that's the law. The settlement, and this was something that we really pushed along with the mayor because he actually put it up in 2012 for the city council to vote on, right? Mayor Tom Tate, after the riots in July of 2012, and our lawsuit was already filed, he actually asked the council, why don't we just put it on the ballot in November 2012?
Seemed like the easiest thing to do.
Let the people decide. Why deal with a lawsuit?
And not just deal with the lawsuit, actually cost money, take money out of the pockets of the citizens.
Oh, yeah, lawsuits are expensive, right?
That's right. So he proposed that, and the current council member who's there now was running for office at the time, and he opposed putting it on the ballot in 2012. Why he did that is pretty clear. His comments were very, very much aligned with what the Disney Corporation sent a letter saying, we support districts, but let's take our time with it, and let's think through it first. So it was a stall tactic, right, is what it was, because a presidential election year is when we know most voters tend to come out. So for us, the whole process was really clearly signaled that.
So you're saying they wanted it to be on the ballot in a non-presidential year?
Because you have lower turnout.
Right.
If
at all.
Lower engagement.
In other words, just stall.
Right.
But to get to your broader point, again, we saw the city come together across economic, racial, geographic, professional,
occupational lines. Yeah, there's lots of ways to divide people.
No, what I'm saying is folks came together.
Yes, right.
And 70% of the voters approved moving to districts, which was quite validating. Every precinct in the city of Anaheim, except one, and that's only one voter lives in that precinct, so almost all but one, the majority said, we want to move to a district election environment. So that's a united city.
Sounds like it.
Saying we need more reflective, localized representation in this large city. So that really...
Will of the people.
So that validated not on racial terms.
Economic terms, right?
Economic, just simple good government. And that's why the mayor, who is a Republican conservative mayor, leaning libertarian, joined with us because people are still very critical of him from the conservative side. And his argument was a very basic one, which goes to what you're suggesting, Paul, which is, he said, look, a government closest to the people is the best form of government. And the city of Anaheim is too large now to work in an at-large system where the regular person doesn't have a shot at even thinking about running for office, or someone who wants to speak or engage on issues about the people doesn't have a shot because they won't get the money to run, even if they're a well-known or viable candidate. Now, here's where I think the logic of what you're suggesting goes against the very fabric of what we're taught in our schools.
Right.
Because if we take your logic model, Paul, about it creates division, then you're suggesting we shouldn't have states. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have congressional districts. We shouldn't have assembly or senate districts. Mm-hmm. So to me, the more fundamental argument for us is the closer you can bring people to their ability to influence the election that impacts them, the better it is for good government, for accountability, for transparency, because you know, and this is what's happening in Anaheim, you no longer have to depend on mailers to tell you how your local councilman is doing,
right,
or councilwoman. You now know, and this happened on Wednesday night or Tuesday, Monday night, is a city council person gets up and he proclaims that all these great things are happening in the city. Now you have 180 people in this room, and then he also said that 2 weeks prior to another forum of just the district itself. And you could just, it was palpable, the reaction in the room was, that's just not true.
Yeah.
You know, our streets are not as pretty as you're saying. Our streetlights are not up like you're saying. No, we don't ever see you walking the neighborhoods.
Right.
No, our parks are not as pretty as you're saying. And he heard that pretty loudly and also was taking credit for what people had been doing for years and tried to take credit for them. So people were able to say, that's not true. You couldn't do that in an at-large environment because he doesn't have to attend forums in an at-large environment.
And that's my answer to you, Paul, okay? Because I've struggled with that same question, right? Because they were talking about in San Clemente and using it in terms of population numbers as a reasoning, right? Which I found to be kind of weak as an argument. But if the result of actually having a districting happen, based on some legitimate reason, quantifiable reason, right? Not just whim, right? If that means that people get more engaged, if people get less dependent on slate mailers to tell them, if people actually are so informed that they can weed through the noise and actually have a clear idea what's going on in their communities, then that is a price worth paying. Because that makes for exactly what we're talking about. It's not in disenfranchisement anymore. Okay, it's actually people getting engaged, getting involved, volunteering, potentially serving in one of the capacities as a fireman or a policeman or whatever.
Yeah.
This is building a community versus tearing it down by apathy.
My wife was given, at her school at Dale Junior High, she was given a shirt by one of her teachers that says democracy is a verb. District elections.
Takes action. It's an action verb.
It's about democracy as a verb and not as an outcome, right? So if the process is transparent and it's inclusive and respects people's civil rights and the franchise of the vote, then the outcome is what people are willing to live with, which is why the whole Trump thing about a rigged election has people really nervous, including the media, because of that. Is how dare you question the process? So district elections allows us to clearly see the process much clearer.
And to make you feel
you're
like you have a voice
process,
in the thing.
Yeah.
So let me give you two reactions to that, which have sort of off the wall, but that's what I'm known for.
Is it still the devil talking? Or
No. No, this is me talking. Just to show you how one group can come to dominate anything. Look at what's happened in the Democratic Party here in the state of California. Overwhelmingly, the candidates for governor, for senator, for statewide seats come from the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And I've asked this many times. First time we have Loretta Sanchez is running I don't know, she must represent like Anaheim or something somewhere
right
around there.
Yeah, it's part of that area.
And she's running and widely not seen to get the seat against Kamala Harris, who was the district attorney, I think, in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be sort of a power base up in the Bay Area that has controlled the Democratic Party for generations now.
But that's how our political system has been rigged because of cost. I mean, if you need X number of dollars, you have to be indebted to people for running. The higher the office, the bigger the price tag, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, just going beyond, I mean, we're using Anaheim as an example here, obviously, and because Jose is running, but, you know, take it to the next level. We need term limits. We need campaign finance reform.
We certainly need campaign finance reform.
All these things are necessary because if you don't do that, again, you get entrenched where your job becomes re-election versus the doing of the job that you went in there to do.
So I just point out that this isn't just along racial lines. It isn't just along economic lines. It can just be regional differences. Northern California is not the largest part of our state, and yet they have controlled the Democratic Party, which controls the state now here. Right. Why? How?
How do you feel?
Well, it's about power, right? Once you got it,
it's an intoxicant. You need it.
Yeah,
anyway.
Power isn't given, it's taken, right, is the saying, and I forget who
said that. That's a powerful one.
So I think coming back to why this, all of this matters for us, and why Anaheim is so important, and it's become important to Orange County, and I hope the state, is the realization that maybe Bernie Sanders kind of really introduced. Mm-hmm. Trump is trying to co-opt, but it's not working. It's bringing people power back to people,
yes,
and taking that power because it's been structurally just
systematically
concentrated, mm-hmm, right? And so power feeds power. So if you want to be a viable candidate or be able to get access to try to influence the decision making stream, you have to have money or you have to curry favors to get in there. Ideas in themselves aren't enough. Mm-hmm. And I want to go back to your opening, Rod, today, which is really interesting because we do put it back on politicians. And there's a distinction I learned from a good friend, Mike Garcia, who was on Santa Ana City Council. Mm-hmm. And I jokingly said as a friend one time to him, "Oh, you're just a politician." And he got very serious and said, "No, I'm an elected official." Mm-hmm. And I said, "You know, what's the difference, man? Same thing, right?"
Right.
And his response is something that certainly informs my work as a candidate, but just how I engage with elected officials is the politician is the one who enters office first day, and he or she's their first thought is, "I want to do good things, but I also want to get reelected."
Right.
And invariably, their getting reelected becomes more important. Right. That is, mm-hmm, the goal of being there isn't what matters. It's I have to be here to implement
just
a goal
here
is what matters,
right?
Right? An elected official says, "I was elected to do something, and I'm going to do it. And if I do it well, then the people will decide in 4 years if I should continue or not, and I won't let the re-election process get into my mind."
Wow.
So you're a servant, right? Very different cultural ways of looking at how one serves. So when I think of the...
When have we had category number two? I hear a lot of category. And I think what you brought out
you're talking to one right now.
Yeah, you
are. That was just... Self-promotion there.
Self-promotion.
There's because many, we used to have citizen politicians, that ideal of having people serve and then leave.
And that's why district elections matters. Because mm-hmm, in order to get your goals engaged and pushed, the moment you push against power, there's a lot of money that can be spent against you. And that's what freaks people out. So you do have a lot of good citizen
scares them away too,
who go in and for the sake of the agenda, which is a good agenda, could be they hold off because they do end up believing that it's better to stay and fight than to be kicked out, right? Mm-hmm. Under these really bad mailers.
Yeah.
But if I could just – the other piece of your reading that you did, Rod, is it's also about us, the electorate, right, that – They do throw fear at us and fear mongering, but it's up to us that when the Police Officers Association or the Firefighters Association says, "Vote for this person because this person is gonna threaten public safety," who in their right mind wants to serve public office to increase crime?
Mm-hmm.
Who in their right mind wants to go into public office to lessen the effectiveness of our police department and our paramedics? Nobody does. But they throw that out at people, and I think that's on us, the electorate, to say, "You know what? I'm going to look at who sent me this mailer, mm-hmm, and there's an interest there, and what is that interest?"
And that's the sad reality about negative advertising. Everybody says they hate it, but it works.
I'm going to share something relevant to those mailers if anybody's listening. Okay, it's just something I learned this week. Okay, if you get one of those mailers and you're looking at it and you're thinking that particular candidate had a hand in that mailer, okay, look and see. In the case where the candidate has actually spent money for that mailer, there's an old asterisk next to their name. If there isn't an asterisk next to their name, there is an entity that put that candidate's name on that mailer for whatever purpose.
That's right.
Right? So even
and they're required to disclose it at the bottom.
Right.
Of,
and
goodness.
So who it is, right?
Right.
And that's a recent thing, by the way.
Although it's, they hide behind these generic names, the Committee for Safety, the Committee for Children.
Right, but they didn't even have to. You didn't used to even have to do that just very recently.
Yeah.
This is a new change that where you have to disclose it on the mailers. So again, I think to Jose, to your point, voting or what did you say was a verb? Voting was
democracy.
Democracy
is a verb.
Is a verb. Engagement is not just basically turning on 5 minutes of news and basically then going and voting based on name recognition or what sounds good, right? Engagement, in my mind, is you do the hard work as a citizen. I mean, again, I will repeat it over and over. I wasn't born in a country where we had the right to vote.
Yes.
When I came here and I basically became of voting age in the United States and registered, okay, that was not just a right, but it was also a responsibility to be engaged, to be informed,
yes,
to do the hard work, to educate myself so that when I go to that booth and I actually exercise my duty in a solemn way, I am doing it as an informed person. I'm looking at all sides.
When I came to California, rented a house, bunch of other young guys up in Hollywood, wanted to be actors, and the guy who owned the house was from Iran. And one day he came over and started talking to us about, he could hardly speak English, and we must have kidded him or said something. And he said, well, I'm from Iran. And he told us a story of how he escaped in the middle of the night. The Ayatollah came in and all this stuff, and his family packed up, left everything behind, dodged police cars, threats, death threats, everything else, left it all behind. And I literally looked at him, I'm 22, and I look at him and I said, why? Why would you do all that? That's scary. You gave up everything. You risked everything. And he looked at me and he said, freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, freedom? What's that? Freedom, you know? Freedom. What's the big deal with freedom, you know? I really honestly thought that way because, like, okay, freedom. It's like air. It's like water. It's just everywhere.
And by the way,
so if you don't have it, it means something.
By the way, for all the use the word freedom flippantly.
Yeah, right.
There is no real freedom if you're oppressing somebody else in the process.
Well, that's right. True, too.
And, yeah. And neither the one oppressing or oppressed is free.
No.
Because to be human isn't to oppress, and to be human isn't to be oppressed. It's to be human, which
correct,
is to fulfill your
and that's an interesting point, because freedom means that you are free of any outside influences. If I am locked into a relationship where I'm holding you down and you're pushing back, neither one of us is free to let go.
Well, so before we get to the point of the show where we tell people they're free to leave,
okay. Which is coming.
I do actually want to touch on this. We've talked a lot about this, but I think again to take it to the bigger picture. Okay, our immediate county, the mix, be it ethnic or religious or whatever, is changing. It has changed,
yeah.
Right? So what do you see? I mean, we've talked about this. There's a little bit of like people probably listening to the show going, "Oh my God, it seems so overwhelming." How hopeful do you feel?
I feel extremely hopeful so long as our political system is structured to allow people to feel like their vote's going to matter. When people don't feel like their vote or their voice is going to matter, that's when you see disengagement, that's when you see tribalism, that's when you see self-interest take over and group interest, and then special interests who then exploit that. So I'm extremely hopeful and optimistic that now, because of our lawsuit, I would say in Anaheim, and what other cities saw as the writing
sets
on the wall,
of precedence, right?
Right, the precedence. And by our work, I mean a lot, hundreds of people who helped organize around this effort. Is we now have, I believe, 9 cities who now have moved to district elections. Mm. We have school districts that have moved to district elections. So it just means that people are acting on the possibilities of democratic practice, which is the vote, right? So I think. What makes me hopeful and optimistic, what I know it does, I shouldn't say I think, is that we're now having a very explicit conversation about who controls our government. Do the people control our government, or do corporate interests, or back alley conversations, or larger, bigger interests control our government,
or
entrenched groups?
Well, and here's the thing: when I was at that candidates forum on Monday, I was laughing at myself because I was a victim of my own bubble too. Right? I've been so engaged with the stuff in San Clemente, and I'm paying attention because I know people like Jose and a bunch of friends that live in Anaheim, plus my involvement with the Arab American Civic Council. the funny thing is, it is, I caught myself actually kind of being a little surprised that some of the topics that came up in some of the questions of the candidates, things like, you know, sober living homes, short-term rentals, affordable housing, big issue in
homeless,
homeless shelter, all this stuff that is trigger words that I was hearing in San Clemente. I caught myself kind of like going, oh, that's funny. They have the same topics here, and I'm like, why did I even think that was odd? You know,
they're
like,
different. They're different.
But that's my point. My point is that all these things, including what maybe Anaheim went through as far as the district in question, okay, these are issues or topics that are of interest to people across at least the county, if not the country, right? And things like sober living homes, things like affordable housing, things of about how to engage the community.
Is there issues you hear week after week in this station?
Right. These are common things.
Right. And here's where the possibilities are, why I'm optimistic, is by moving to systems of governance and elections that are closer to the people. For years, we would talk to Congresswoman Sanchez about certain positions she was taking or not taking or being silent about that we knew she supported. With Lou Correa, with Tom Daley, with ours. And we would consistently hear, you know, this is a conservative county, it's a conservative city, I have to be very moderate, I can't get too left or right, although it always seemed like a very corporatist, which is not left or right, I think, it's just control. But nonetheless, they would say that they had to be moderate because of a moderate electorate. And through this process, what we've learned very clearly is we're putting that up as a question. Is the electorate moderate or has it been moderated? That is, when you have corporatist influencers who control the messages that people get, be it through media, through mailers, campaigns that they're allowed to run or not run, candidates that are funded to run on certain messages, then the electorate doesn't really know its full buffet of options, right? So if you even mention the specter of Disneyland doing more for its community in terms of finances or questioning whether it should get a $300 million corporate tax subsidy to build a luxury hotel, you're seen as anti-business. You're immediately framed as anti-police because that's supposed to fund police. So then we get moderated. So what I'm excited about in this district election environment is now we're really hearing the true voice of the people about what they want. And now we, the candidates, have to either speak to the issues of the people or not get elected in.
Which I will say, right? I'll say this, Jose, for a city that is, like, I looked at the list, okay, the largest in Orange County, okay, like, you know, it was like, I think, like the fifth or like the eighth or something. It's like, you know, Los Angeles, some large Riverside County, you know, Riverside, huge cities. For a city in Orange County with this large a population, okay, with that many districts, to now, for a split second in time at least, hopefully longer than a split second, have a very clear short distance between the voice of the people and those basically at city council is phenomenal.
Right.
The layers have, to have those layers, multiple layers, drop down, the surrogates, the intermediaries, all this stuff, for that to be a direct communication, a direct discussion that's happening between candidates for city council and the people is phenomenal.
And let me give you one other hopeful thought.
Because you expect that in a small town. But in town with, what's the population, 300,000 people?
Right.
We have 350. We're primarily Business Channel, so we have a lot of business people come in here.
Not this show.
A lot of Republicans come in here. I'm not one of them, but there are. I'm really, you know what I am? I'm a liberal Republican.
Are you moderate or moderated?
I'm a liberal Republican. Liberal on social issues, conservative on government size.
Most people are.
Which is what the Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, so that's what I think most people are. But anyway, I don't exist in any world anymore here. Having said that, you're all talking about here, the government that is closest to the people has the best chance of representing the people, is a theme that I hear from Republican leaders and business leaders over and over again. And maybe it's because they're taking more of a libertarian turn, people like Tom Tate you're talking about. So we're all saying, gee, there's nothing that can bring us together anymore. The left and the right have nothing in common. They have two things in common. One, a belief in bringing government to the people, to the lowest level. And two, if Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump represent anything, a fear of special interest, not just corporate interest, but special interest, money interest, wealthy unions, corporations, big something that comes in and controls things.
The moderating that Jose was talking
big
about.
Big money is seems to be feared on both sides. And that's the way I feel. When you put the word big in front of something, I'm afraid of it already.
Right. So they would be the moderators. right? Yeah. And so, although I think that the question of, I think both Republicans and Democrats who are authentic about their philosophy of their party, which is why we see a lot of people going independent, is that neither...
The largest group in Orange County now is refused to...
Neither group, neither major party, nor the, neither the declined states, like crony capitalism.
No.
Right? By whatever names you give it, corporate giveaways, crony capitalism, corporate welfare, we don't like that. And so what's happening, I'm optimistic about Anaheim.
And I grew up in the Midwest where that crony capitalism also, I'm sorry to say, represented big unions. Where big unions bought elections and did things and brought their members along and all this stuff. I mean, big, when you get to be big, you start representing only your interests and not other people's interests. That's my philosophy.
So institutions then control people, and whether it's government or an institution, and it's really about people, right? Mm-hmm. And so right. And that's why especially local city councils, local school boards are really the last kind of line of defense to that complete takeover of people's lives, right? Is city councils have to stand up to the company in the company town and say no.
To the man, right?
You know, so what we need is, so people say, I'm glad you mentioned business, that because, again, I'm taking these positions about how Disney, $300 million corporate giveaway over 20 years to build a luxury hotel, Wincom, another $300 million, $280 million to build another four-star luxury hotel in Anaheim 2 years before that, a local hotel developer, $156 million corporate giveaway, and somehow all that's supposed to trickle down to the people.
Right.
And the people are saying, but we can't even play soccer in our parks. There's no grass in our parks. The parks aren't big enough to host soccer league tournaments, or baseball fields aren't big enough or quality enough. We still have very broken streets. And where are the broken streets? They tend to be in the most high-poverished, high-concentrated poverty areas of Anaheim, which is District 3 and the West Side. So what this is allowing, again, us to say is, in Anaheim at least, and I hope it plays out in other cities and countywide even, is, again, look at who is sponsoring your candidates, look at where they're pursuing their money, and there are independent expenditures, so you kind of can't hold them to that, but is that independent expenditure connected in a way that's about controlling people or institutions? And that's what we're, again, the whole comes in.
And what's funny is even those entities that are maybe having that special interest, they themselves use that tactic of pointing at the other opponent and saying they're bought and paid for, which is really interesting to watch because
you deflected away from
it. We've almost gotten to the point where I expect somebody to tell me who bought and paid for who, and it's going to be pointing. And this is the thing that kills the political dialogue, I think, and working towards things in common together, is I want you to vote for me not because of what I bring to the table, but because I'm not the other person.
Yes, well,
right. That gets my attention. But you got to give me more than that. There's got to be more substance to why you want to earn my vote.
But that's the whole election process these days. If as long as I make it about the other guy, then I never have to get too much scrutiny.
Jose,
about me.
Go ahead.
Right, and so to that point, it goes back to your initial reading, Rod, which is this question of what do voters want. Right. And so you end up messaging to what voters need to hear. So one is, in any election, they either want change or they want that they like the way things are.
Right.
If they don't like the way things are, they don't quite know why they are the way they are. So you have to point out the difference. Well, look, this current city council has voted X, Y, and Z, and that's why we don't have streets the way we'd like them to be. You can't tell the difference in many parts of our city between Stanton, Buena Park, and Anaheim. Mm-hmm. Yet we have two professional sports stadiums and teams, world-class resort, and yet our streets often look no different than any other city surrounding us. 90% of our kids in our schools...
So you're saying that hasn't trickled down to a noticeable effect in the city.
So 90% of our kids in our schools are on free and reduced lunch, which means they're low income. And who are their families? Their families are those who are working in an economy that is based in tourism or service sector. So that means, okay, if you're going to keep attracting those kind of jobs, resort industry, because you want to keep the city's money to keep investing in you and for you to grow, then how does the city provide basic services?
Yeah, you can.
Right? So to finish my point on this is that's why it's so difficult in elections when people say, well, we want a thoughtful election, we want a thoughtful campaign, but at the end we just want sound bites.
Yeah.
And so if you're thoughtful about policy, it's hard to articulate that in a mailer or in a soundbite of a commercial or even in a forum. I mean, in the forums I've participated in, we've been told explicitly, don't attack the other candidate. To me, that means you don't say, he or she's ugly, he or she, you know, goes to bars.
Short, right, yeah.
You know, to me, but to say, well, this person has voted for this, and then I was
that's
telling you something
record.
Different, that's now framed as an attack. And you think, well, then how do we have a public discourse to let the voter, to not moderate the voter?
So here's what I'm going to do. This show should have ended 7 minutes ago. I'm going to extend it to 1:30. Let's do that. Because I think this is a fascinating discussion. It's the type of discussion about what type of democracy do we want? What kind of people do we want? And I let me ask, the only trade-off is I get to ask a couple questions.
Absolutely.
All right.
But as long as any devil asks me, as long as it's you.
No, it's me.
let me just add one thing, though, right?
Because, take the time away.
Hold on a second, Paul, because this is one of those things that I really feel strongly about, okay?
Yes.
You cannot talk to me. And I'm an undergraduate economics major. I have a degree in economics. I went down the path of business, okay? I own my own business. Okay, I've grown and lived in multiple countries. Okay, the point is this: you cannot convince me, if I have a brain cell in my head, that you're going to basically set up a big huge thing. I want all the tax benefits for it. I'm going to have all these jobs, but it turns out that they're low paying jobs, and then somehow that is going to cause people to be able to afford to live in my community when I'm not going to also champion affordable housing. You cannot just take one piece and say this is what's beneficial for me on the bottom line as a corporation and then not champion other things. If you want to have jobs in there and you're saying that those jobs basically trickle down to the community and people who live in those communities, then you got to deal with affordable housing. You want to improve the community, then you have to basically look at those parks that are not being supported. Not only what is happening in my immediate landscaped area within my block. Okay, if you really genuinely are saying that I'm going to be a steward of this community and I deserve to receive some preferential treatment because I will then turn around and amplify that goodness elsewhere, you gotta stand for this. You gotta stand for affordable housing. You gotta stand for education. Re-education of people that are basically lost their jobs. You got to stand for all that. You don't get to pick and choose what's beneficial to your bottom line and your P&L and then not basically deal with the fact that the grass is dying two blocks down from your building.
So here, all right, having said that, we'll hit the applause again here. Here's my questions to your guest here. When do corporations start caring more for their bottom line than they do for their workers, their community, their consumers?
That's their job, Paul. They've got shareholders.
Okay, but stop. You just said the magic word, shareholders. When they become a public company, when they become... I see a lot of entrepreneurial companies here, big companies. We had one in here yesterday. I'll just give them a shout-out. A company called The Wonderful Company. I never heard of it. They own Palm Juice, the pomegranate juice, and Fiji Water, and a handful of other things like that you would recognize. And they pulled it all together based out of Los Angeles. And they're a $4 billion company, but they're not – maybe they are public, but they're still run as an entrepreneurial outfit. The two people who founded it out of nothing still do it. I see this with Google. I see this with lots of other entrepreneurial tech companies where even though they get bigger, they still feel a roots to the people and to the community. They still want to have a community. They don't do it just so you'll buy the product. They really, truly believe they want to make the world better.
Yes, there's a social consciousness element.
And it's almost built
into
their corporate DNA. I think the moment is, I'm going to answer my own question, when something becomes too big is the word that scares me. Just as I'm afraid of big labor, or big business, I'm also afraid of big labor. I'm also afraid of big government. I'm also afraid of anything that gets too big that suddenly isn't out for the general welfare anymore, but is just trying to throw their weight around to get preferential treatment for their specific group of people. Big is what scares me.
So
the second question is, so why wouldn't Disney? I understand they want to get tax credits and whatnot. I get that. But why wouldn't they want the community to be better around them? And I'll give you an example. Quicken Loans moved into Detroit. Didn't have to move into Detroit, but they felt that they wanted to make an impact in whatever community they lived in. Detroit was depressed. I'm from Detroit. And they went into downtown, and they started fixing up the community around them, partly because they wanted to attract better people to work there, partly because they wanted to have a good corporate image that they're helping, but mostly because they wanted that was part of their mission, to make an impact in the community. And I would think Disney, I don't want to go in. Sometimes I'm afraid to go over to Disneyland because it looks rough and tough at night or whatever issue.
How do you build two blocks? How do you build that balance, Jose?
Well, they managed to get the city council and the state to invest in the entire redesign of the resort district, so you wouldn't have to drive through the streets anymore, Paul. You just go in straight through the freeway and avoid where people are. And, you know, it's become just like any other tourist destination, right, where you don't have to see they call the resort industry in Anaheim the economic engine. That's what Chris Murray, Jordan Brandman, Lucille Crane, the current incumbents.
Yes, I hear that thrown around
a lot.
They
call it a lot, economic engine, and they don't let you see the exhaust of that engine because...
Wow. You've really got some great visuals. Right? Yeah, exactly.
Well, and it's literal. I mean, the fireworks every single night, that lights it up. The smoke, what's that called? The residue of those fireworks lands somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it tends to land in the most impoverished areas of Anaheim. It doesn't land in the hills, for sure, although unless the winds hit right. But to answer your question, how do we know? I think this is where Bernie Sanders and... ironically, Donald Trump, I think all these folks are at least speaking to this. Jill Stein, Gary Johnson, is at the end of the day, here's where I say common sense just has to kick in.
Mm-hmm.
Disney wants and demanded up to 45 year local tax exemption. If the people of Anaheim ever decide that they wanted to vote for, because you have to vote for any tax, to vote for a tax that may impact Disney directly, Disney is now exempt from that tax for up to 45 years in exchange for them investing in Star Wars land and other things up to $1 billion, a billion and a half. Sounds like a great deal. Then they come, and so they get that. Mm-hmm. And so, one, it disenfranchises the voter. If I, as a voter, want to implement a tax and 90% of the voters agree on a tax, why shouldn't it be honored, right? Why do three people get to decide that my vote no longer matters if I want to implement some revenue streams of a tax? Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting we should tax them. I'm just saying the people should decide that. Second, so that's now by contract out for 45 years. Second, they come back and say, we want to build a 4-star hotel because there's a great demand in the market. Mm-hmm. The Grand California is constantly at capacity. Mm-hmm. So we know there's a market. And we'd like the city to give us $280 million of future revenue, bet taxes, to do that. That's where we calculated out per the proposal. And it works out to about $8 million a year for Disney. I'm sorry, $8 million every $6 to $8 million every 6 months. We're going to write a check to them for 20 years. Right, based on projected revenues.
We'll give you this if you'll do that.
Right, so you think, okay, so that's about $14 to $16 million a year. The Disney CEO of the corporation, Bob Iger, don't know the man, so it's nothing personal.
He's on next here.
He makes $45 million a year. Yet the people of Anaheim have to pay his corporation $15 million a year. So I'm thinking, well, why doesn't the company... ask Bob Iger to kick in $15 million to help build that hotel. Why do the people of Anaheim, of which over a quarter are in abject poverty, again, 90% of our kids are on free and reduced lunch. So his employees that he pays a minimum wage to, or if not close to a minimum wage, nowhere near a living wage, will now have to be the ones to give up their revenue as a body politic so that he can keep getting paid $45 million.
And I don't want to say this as an indictment.
And how is that conservative fiscally conservative on the part of the city leadership, okay, to give up that kind of revenue for the benefit of the community?
Jerry Brown was recently criticized for not going after Tesla's battery factory stronger, and his answer was, it was a bad deal.
Exactly, and that's the point, Paul. I do not begrudge business. Business exists for one reason. Disney,
make money.
Disneyland today does not exist. People don't buy stock in there because, hey, you know what? It makes kids happy. I want to buy stock in that.
Exactly, right.
They buy it because it's going to make them money. And,
right.
and pensions invest in there, right? Mm-hmm. So we're all connected to it. So at the end of the day, I don't begrudge the business community. They're doing what they're set up to do. Make as much money as you can for your investors, right?
Right.
And all I'm suggesting is, well, the city council should be doing what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to serve the people. And as much as Citizens United might want to say over and over, corporations are not people, right? And I think we all can agree they're not people. So when you're taking the money of the people to give to an entity, you're now putting public money into a private entity. That is a giveaway. It's a gift of public funds. I think it's illegal. I think it's immoral. It's unethical. And for that, we get vilified, both left and right. Yes. Right? Because the mayor's been vilified as well for this. So, and center.
So I think there's hope that you've got a lot of Republicans in this community who have held leadership positions who are taking a much more libertarian view, which is let's bring government down as close as we can to the people, and let's not to the Bernie Sanders camp and to the some core of Donald Trump's camp, let's not buy into the giveaway mentality anymore.
Right.
Let's not give into the special interest. But as long as money has such power, as long as it costs so much money to run, it's hard to see how politicians aren't going to go.
It goes back to exactly
follow
that
the
point.
Money.
When your job becomes more about being reelected than actually doing the job that you were elected to do, that's when the thing just falls apart.
What he said earlier was the most insightful way of describing that I've ever heard. I'm not trying to just blow smoke here, but you really struck me.
Thank you.
You really did, because you said a politician gets in saying, I want to do something, okay? And then they quickly realize, if I don't stay elected, it's not going to get done. Part of me doing that goal, the trade-off is I got to be here long enough to see it through and to get it done. So you start making a deal with the devil. You start saying, then I guess I got to, that's got to become the foe. If I really believe in what I did, why I'm doing this, then I got to stay in office. Rather than trusting, no, I came here to do a job, and if I do that job, people will recognize it and reelect me here.
That's right.
I can see how good
you know what happens to a person in a job environment if especially if they're a consultant, when they go into a position where they're basically supposed to do something, a service, and then say to them, to the person who hired them, well, you know, we had it estimated to do this thing in 4 years, but now I'm going to need 12 to get it done. You know what happens to that person? They get fired.
Yeah. Right. So, but to your point, it doesn't mean one doesn't compromise as an elected official. So,
compromise is a key ingredient, unfortunately.
And I go back to in a district environment, I know that there are things that I'm going to want for District 3, if I'm blessed enough to be elected, that I know that I won't be able to do everything. And that's where in the campaign we're saying, look, this is what I want to do, but we're going to have to work with other districts. And so they may need a different kind of service in their area that we don't maybe need. So I'm going to support that. And that's the log rolling piece, right? Mm-hmm. But what becomes a problem is that we only do and are only driven by those who are funding the campaigns.
Right.
That's the problem, right? Instead of the people, once again. So
what do you want to see happen in Anaheim?
Yeah, there you go.
I want to see...
Would you like to see Anaheim stop? I know this has been... It sounds like you have some issues with Disney. I'm not trying to make this about
Disney.
I do
not have issues with Disney. I have issues with the horrible negotiators we have on our city council.
There you go. Okay.
Who don't know how to negotiate deals for the public.
Nice, unlike Donald Trump.
Yeah. I do not have an issue with Disney. Disney is a company that exists to make money, and they do a very good job at it. In fact, I commend them that they're so good at what they do. But unfortunately, for whatever reason, it's at the they don't realize to how
they're
much
dominating.
It's at the expense of.
But that's not that's
so
not
should
their responsibility. That's the responsibility of the elected leadership.
So should Anaheim move like Detroit and others are trying to move to be less of a company town and to broaden and diversify their
economic
business
engine?
Yeah. You have to look at it. I think the way that we look at nationally is that
because if you're held hostage by one thing, it's hard to say no to that one thing.
So Disney is a huge employer. And in fact, the other danger of a corporate kind of run
town
geography, be it a city or even county, is they also tend to control media.
Yes.
Right. So I'll give you an example. It just came out today.
They don't control OC Talk Radio. I'm more of an independent voice.
I'm looking around the room. I see a lot of really cool grassroots and corporate stuff. It's a nice mix in here.
Yeah.
So the Register today announced their endorsement in Anaheim.
Mm-hmm.
And in District 4, they chose not to endorse the current city councilwoman, Lucille Kring, in part, they said, because of her constant support for these sweetheart corporate deals
mm-hmm.
that she's been voting for in support of these corporate mm-hmm. Tax deals, giveaways, and that she said that she didn't support those, and then she did, and she says that because she realized they're a good deal. In my district, they endorsed Jordan Bradman, who's voted for those exact deals. So I look back at that, well, why would that be?
Yeah.
Is that hypocritical? Is it contradictory?
Seems like contradictory, yeah.
And then you look at who are the biggest revenue ad clients, right? You go on OC Register's website, on the front page of every website every day, there's something about Disney. Their local reporter, who I won't name, but you could look at his card, his Twitter account is OC at OC Disney. This is the reporter for the Register. So to me, it's like there's no way you're going to endorse a Jose Moreno or a Robert Nelson who are saying stop the corporate giveaways. They're going to say, look, you need to endorse or support, right? I'm not questioning so much the integrity of those journalists or the opinion writers, but it just smells funny. Something smells rotten.
Like they're really, for the same reason you did not endorse one, you actually, on those deals, you then endorse somebody who actually also supported those.
And it smells like, my friend, I know very little about Anaheim politics other than it can be pretty rough and tumble, and they've had lots of contentious elections and contentious city councils over there. That they're also running a campaign. Somebody magically is running with your same name in another district here?
In 2014.
Gee, that wouldn't be too confused the public, would it be?
Right. In 2014, they ran a candidate. I don't know him, but a candidate appeared on the ballot with the same name, which is why I have to use the moniker Dr. Jose F. Moreno to differentiate. It's not out of arrogance. And in this cycle, that same person is running. Now, here's why it's problematic and why what leads people to believe and certainly leads me to believe.
Is it running or just the name on the ballot?
Exactly. There's no evidence of a serious campaign. They don't show up to forums. They're not knocking on doors, at least from any accounts that we can tell.
Political trickery.
And now there's yard signs that magically appeared. And he's in a different district. The yard signs that are appearing are not appearing on actual yards. They're appearing in public spaces, right, as you exit the freeways. and it's right on the border of District 3 and 4. It doesn't seem to appear in the core central area
really
of District 4.
This out.
Now, again, they could be there. I just maybe haven't seen them. I've asked friends there. They haven't seen anything except on the peripheries. And the lawn sign says, vote Joe Moreno. He changed it to Joe. Vote Latino si se puede. Now, given what we talked about earlier about districts, our opposition has tried very heavily to racialize that I only care about Latinos. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're trying to scare some people into thinking that that's me, and so that's why you got to vote against me. So that's why I'm going to encourage people to just constantly read. There's no candidate statement.
And it only works because the public doesn't pay attention. That's the ugly reality. If the public really was engaged, the poor people, the rich people, the Hispanic people, the Anglo people, everybody, we're all susceptible to this game. We all think it doesn't matter. We don't care enough to find out the answer. And so we make our decision based on flip.
Am I just being naive, or do you feel that we're getting to a point where those kind of tactics actually are going to have the opposite effect that it's intended?
I hope so, but there isn't any evidence of that. We'll find out this election cycle. Ugly still works, and the public still, by and large, doesn't pay attention, and which is why I extended this, because I think these kind of conversations should be had all the time.
And that's why I'm optimistic and hopeful and optimistic about your question about where we're going, because in a district environment, the closer you are to the election process, then the more you can react to it. So you do take a risk if you do a really ugly negative attack ad, personalized attack, or a racialized one,
or just a lie,
or misstating a record of somebody, or stating a lie. Then very quickly word will spread. Right? There's neighborhood based listservs. There's Facebook, of course, social media. So you need is 5,000 people to get mad at what you're doing, and you're in trouble. If in an at-large system, 5,000 people get mad at you, you don't care. Because ultimately, it's 120,000.
Well, but I will say this: I will say that districting is also not the magic cure.
Right.
Okay. You still have to be engaged and informed enough to be able to distill through the label. Okay. Because I have a feeling that it will become the next vehicle used for other ulterior motives and special interests. You have to look at the grounds for the district. You have to look at
big money is always going to find a way to control and protect their interests. They have since the founding of this country here. Right. You know, the railroads did it. The banks did it. Other groups have done it.
So don't buy into the label. Buy into the fact that, you know, or at least support the fact that it's something or anything, call it whatever it may be, that will cause more engagement and closer communication between that leadership and the voter.
You know what the answer is? The answer is more stations like OC Talk Radio. Really, where we can talk about these
things. I'll tell you, Voice of OC, as an investigative news agency, I left them out of the conversation earlier. They are one of the reasons why we've been successful, is that we don't depend on the OC Register to report or not report on
I would love
things,
to
right?
have them come on one of our shows sometime. Right? I've forgotten his name, the gentleman.
Norberto Santana.
Yeah, we can have him.
It's because of that. And then talk radio that can really allow people to get a different perspective.
Have a conversation, right. I mean, I've tried to make this. I've tried to at least present some of what I hear.
So I have a question for you. A racial question.
Then we're going to wrap up.
That's a racial question. It's out of my own experience because of the way that they've tried to frame my candidacy. When I was on the school board, I was on there for 8 years. Mm-hmm. I'm a parent in the schools and just really wanted to help. I would have a number of white residents and white family members who are friends come and say, you know, I'm so glad you're on the school board because we really need to do something to help Latino kids. Mm-hmm. And being that you're Latino, maybe you could relate, you could understand some things, you could maybe provide some insights. And it's good to have someone on there to have diversity, right? So I would say, okay. So they would say, so we're really excited you're going to be able to do that. I said, great. I thank you. I appreciate that support. Once I started asking the question, what can we do to support Latino families, Spanish-dominant families, a lot of those same people came and said, why are you only talking about Latinos? Why are you focusing on Latinos? Why are you racializing it? And I would turn to them and say, you're the one who asked me to make sure to take a look at that. Of course, it's an interest of mine, but my interest is, of course, all kids or all people in a city. But we do, my own experience suggests, and the legal process and the historical process suggests, we have to look at every community onto itself so that we can integrate communities together. Everybody has their own particular spaces and cultural ways or ways that they've been treated or maybe neglected or supported. So I'm wondering, maybe you can give me some insights of the
we'll
white mind.
We'll extend it a few more minutes because I don't want you to shut this off. This is a heavy topic here.
Give me some insights on the white mind of that kind of seeming contradiction. Like, hey, we want you to help Latinos. And then when you do, you're like, why do you only care about Latinos? Right?
I'm going to give you a couple.
Which, by the way, is a bigger question than just pure ethnicity.
That's a big question.
That's right.
Can I just take a few minutes and step back? Because you've hit on a couple things here.
Okay, absolutely.
All right. I'm 60. I'm white. I'm Irish Catholic.
Yes.
The Catholic part used to exclude me when I was a kid because it was a white Protestant nation. So when I was a kid, John F. Kennedy couldn't run for president, and Smith lost the presidency in the 20s because they were Catholics. Somehow Catholics have been – we got bought in. In fact, there's now 4 Catholics on the Supreme Court, which were put there by the white Protestant majority because they were assured that they would vote against abortion.
Look at that.
So somehow we got pulled into the process. So now we're all – whereas the whites used to divide each other up into Catholics and Protestants, or rich and poor, or urban and rural, now we're sort of, you know, we're sort of circling the wagons and we're all invited back in here again, which is why I'm so sensitive about being called white and branded with all this group, because I look at these guys and they say, I'm not part of them. 16 years ago, they didn't want me any more than they wanted you.
Right. That's historical. That's right. That's right.
Irish Catholics were treated as the poorest of the poor and thrown out.
Right. They say in Boston the Irish are the Mexicans of the Northeast.
Yes, exactly. So we've all been there. I mean, every group that came over, the Irish were the first giant wave that came over in the 1840s after the potato famine, and they were treated like dogs, and they were the ones that had the low-level jobs. And then it was Eastern Italians and Southern Europeans, and then it was Eastern Europeans. I'm also part Polish, and they went through that in the 1900s. And now the group of choice are Hispanics and African Americans and whatnot.
And Muslim.
And Muslim, yeah. There's another whole new group that we never even thought of, and Rod can speak to that. He's not Muslim, but he's from the Middle East.
You're assuming that people have the ability to distinguish.
Yeah. Right.
Because when you say Middle Eastern Muslim, that shows a sense of awareness.
Yeah, that's right. You're Middle Eastern, you're Muslim.
My experience has been not the case.
You're right.
Because Rod grew up Greek Orthodox.
People attack Muslims, and the largest concentration of Muslims is actually out of China. I mean, it's
like... That's right.
Right?
So,
Malaysia.
So when you say white, I just cringe. I have for some time at that term. And I hate it when people refer to African-Americans as black. I grew up in a white and black Detroit. It was white and black. Whites lived here, black lived there. And when we start putting it by color, you can't come up with a more differentiating spread than white and black. There is nothing in common between white and black. We're polar opposites. So if I see you as one color, you're not black, but if I saw you as black and you saw me as white, it's hard for us ever to agree on anything. And we also have this image of white being the good guys and the good guys in the movies and all that. I hate all this stuff here. I wish we'd stop calling it that.
I grew up in countries where, you know, the concept of being colorblind Mm-hmm. Okay, it's something I picked up in the United States. Okay, nowhere in my life before I came here was somebody have to tell me I needed to be colorblind in order to be fair, okay? No, I was aware of my surroundings. I was aware of the diversity of people, and I actually embraced it.
I didn't
look at it as grounds for basically segregation, okay? So I do not want to be colorblind. I want to see the diversity in people, but at the same time, I also don't want to act inequality-wise towards any other human being.
So let me give you two. So let me just play on that a little bit, and then I'll get to try and answer your question here. All right, so I cringe when I hear people say, just as any ethnic group doesn't want to see themselves, well, we're all the same, we're all one, or in a religious
group.
Right. So,
right.
Monolithic.
But white has been the dominant culture, this dominant image, which is really English, Anglo-Saxon, English Protestant, that founded the country here. And since then, we've continued that notion that we're an Anglo-English speaking country. When you call me an Anglo, Anglos and Irish hated each other for centuries. I don't want to be called an Anglo, and I don't want to be called a white. I wish we could come up with some other term for the dominant power in the country. That doesn't say that I'm white and doesn't.
By
say
the way,
I'm
the color
Anglo.
The color white is not a like a color. The color white is actually a spectrum of all colors.
Yes, it's all colors blended together. All right. So, having said that, and I further am been pulled into this. For two reasons. One, I come from the Midwest, which is Donald Trump territory. All of my friends, all of my high school friends on Facebook think I have lost my mind. They are all for Donald Trump.
You're just fruits and nuts in California.
They are all rabidly for Donald Trump. They call me traitor and sellout and crazy and what happened to you, because I'm the only one not vote. And I'm saying, I get that you don't like Hillary, you don't like change, I get all this stuff, and the world's changing, it doesn't look like where we grew up, where it's all just white, leave it to beaver land anymore, there's a diversity, you're afraid of it, I embrace it, I get all that's happening, but why do you think Donald Trump is the solution to this guy,
right,
who's never done anything for anybody but himself?
Because I'm desperate for a change.
Now it gets even more complicated, because who am I? I adopted a girl from Mexico. My only child is a daughter I adopted from a village in Mexico who came to this country illegally, fell into foster care, and we found her and adopted her. And we go through this all the time, and she has ethnic uncertainty. She's raised in lily white ethnic South Orange County, but the guy she falls in love with is a poor guy from Hispanic whose parents came here legally, illegal, I don't know, whatever, or something. She lives in Santa Ana, in some of the poorest area in Santa Ana now. My grandchild lives in Santa Ana. And so we are pulled together, these two families. They don't speak English, and we don't speak Spanish. But we have to get together now for family affairs and family events. And I know when we walk over, they look at us like they're scared of us. And I look and I say, I'm scared of them. Why are we scared of each other here? I don't know you, and they don't know me.
You know, can I interject there?
This is what's happening, though, to America. And this is the upheaval that's so throwing the whole world in a tizzy here.
So
a tizzy.
What I'd interject there is I don't know if it's scared of you, because when good people get together and they come from different spaces, I hope I'm a good people. It seems to me, and this is a lived experience piece, it's more a fear of being impolite than is a fear of you.
Yes, right.
Right? So I don't want to offend you.
It's a fear of how I would react.
I want you to feel like welcomed, but I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
And so my language isn't good enough yet to get you there. And then there is people who are just not only afraid, but hateful towards a different culture, right? Mm-hmm. Because of their own insecurities about their own culture.
And every so often they'll say, and I know they're trying to be polite,
a lot of it is in the
but they'll say
too.
Something about white, and I'll say, ooh, that rubs me when you say that, like all whites do this. And at the same time, my father, who passed away a couple of years, who was a great guy, but pretty racially divided here, and he used to rant and rave about Mexicans and all this stuff, and Mexicans are taking over and flooding the American country. But your only grandchild is a Mexican.
Right.
Well, not her, but those illegals. She came over illegally. Well, not her, but all the rest of them. I just, when we start putting each other in, and this is Rod's favorite rant, when we start putting each other in boxes and we start grouping each other, then we immediately start dividing and separating.
You're also a product of your generation, Paul, okay? You've got this
I'm an old hippie.
Utopian hippie approach to things.
I am.
Okay, I can only speak for myself. I don't see humanity as not having this worry, this reaction. I think it's human nature to basically react whether violently or just out of concern and you know, kind of like confusion to what you do not know.
Yes.
Okay. I think it is normal. I think we've gone too far in somehow not allowing for that. I think you got to allow for the fact that people are going to be apprehensive. They may because it's an unknown. Mm-hmm. Well, where we should be exerting our energy is not trying to basically get them all in line with being okay with it. What we're supposed to be doing is actually giving them the benefit and the tools and the ways to make that bridge to one another.
So, right, and historic...
Getting to know people. And before you do, I'll tell you another quick story. Then, yeah. And I know this is a long rant, but you really opened up something. That's why we're dragging it. I do have to hard stop it, too, now.
I got to
show it, too.
I got to go.
Here's what I'll give you one other story. I'm in high school in the 70s.
I told you when we started, we're not going to be able to stop him, right?
All right, well, I'm in high school in the 70s. I grew up in a completely 100% lily white affluent neighborhood. My father was a vice president for Chrysler Corporation. Everybody's dad was a VP or something here. There were no Hispanics, certainly. I don't think in the whole state. There were certainly no African-Americans. There were no Asians. There was nobody. It was all – everybody looked and sounded exactly like me. And when you drove across 8 Mile, the famous 8 Mile Road that Eminem talked about, it was 100% black. 100% white, 100% black. That was the separation that happened after the 60s riots in Detroit. The two just went to their own camp. My father grew up poor in the Polish neighborhoods, and insisted I go down and work in the factories to see what that was like, because I'd never seen any of this. I grew up in a lily-white, affluent neighborhood, and he makes me to drive down into that neighborhood with those people and work in an environment where I am the minority. I'm the only handful of white people in there. And immediately, black people, I hate using that term, but black African-Americans would come to me, and they start saying, you white people. And the only white people that there were hillbillies, who'd come up from the South to work just as the African-Americans come. I look at these hillbillies, and I'm like, I am not one of these guys here.
So
and the hillbillies
poor whites.
And the hillbillies would take me aside and say, well, you're stick with us, boy. You know, at least you're not one of them. And I'm like, I'm not one of either of you group here. I don't understand. You're both from Mars. I just felt so totally unique and alone. I couldn't fall into any of this.
I want to just point out something, right? For anybody who's listening to the show, we started off basically talking about we'll wrap it around. We're talking about districting. We're talking about the need for representation for where there's no underrepresentation, right?
Right.
And you asked a question before we went on the air, and you asked it again to Jose about the fact, well, how is it that this focus, this putting it under the spotlight, right, that certain things are not fair, right, is not going to lead to even further division?
Yes.
Right? And if you've listened to us for the last 30 minutes, you're probably as confused as hell with the answer to that, right? But I will say this, and I answered this question to you when before the show. You said, well, how is it going to – I said, if the problem did not – or the disparity did not already exist –
We wouldn't need to
look at it.
That's a strong argument,
right? So if we didn't have an issue, if like in the case of Anaheim, there wasn't a proven situation where there is not a representation,
and everybody knew it. There's a handful of people that dominated that.
Right, but I want to be careful here, okay? Because I don't want to end the show with even more confusion to the audience as possible, right? Life is constantly changing. We are a diverse community, more so than we have ever been, both on religious and ethnic basis. And I'm talking about Orange County, but I'm also talking about it as an amplified reality of the country.
Yes.
Right? And we have to come to terms with our own issues of feeling maybe put upon or a minority or whatever, and not dishonor that, accept the fact that this is where we are at right now, but also strive to more awareness and more growth to where we can see ourselves beyond this side of the eight mile, that side of 8 Mile, of this side of Santa Ana, or that side of Anaheim, right?
Right.
We cannot ignore the realities that are on the ground, but we can strive for betterment.
So the answer to Jose's question, your first name is Jose, right? I'm sorry,
yes,
I'm terrible at names. I forget
F.
names
Moreno.
Quickly. All right. A group of, we'll say white or Anglo, both of which I chafe under here, but some people that look like me, who've dominated the politics for a long period of time, who founded this country 200 years ago, we need to get out of our bubble. You need to pull them out and look at them as children. If you brought those people and walked them over into what was, you say there's a, I'm sure there are poor school districts of Hispanics, that don't have the same class size, that don't have the same
facilities. There's just poor school districts.
Our whole district is poor.
So bring me into that, and that conversation will stop, and I'll see them as children and not as Latinos.
Right, but that was their point. Their right. point was almost all of our district is Latino. We're so glad that you're going to be able to engage that experience. And once I began to raise the question, well, maybe we can do bilingual programs, and we should be pushing and supporting that. Because, by the way, white kids can also benefit from learning Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
They're called immersion programs. And so
I wish I knew Spanish.
But they turned and said, but look, that means you're only focusing on Latinos. I'm like, no, language is a universal question.
Right.
But
so you have to frame
I know
it.
We got to go, but I just want to just give a couple of resources, if I can, about
yes.
the conversation we just had.
Yes.
There's a great book, because we talked about, is it organic or is it not?
Mm-hmm.
Race is a structured question. It doesn't exist on real terms, but it is a structured social reality.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great book that I would recommend everybody to read called White by Law.
Because
mm-hmm. when you ask, why do people put me in a box? Well, because folks said whites only, right? And so that's what constructed the racial category.
I understand.
I'm just saying it's odd that
I got pulled into it because I was part of the group that used to be excluded.
So we're all living in this contemporary society off the legacies of how our society was constructed, right?
Yes.
So this is, again, it's a great book because it's White by Law, and it lines out historically when did different ethnic groups, including European groups, become legally white. Legally
yes,
white.
Right.
And at the end of the day, if you're not protected by the law, then what do you have any protections from, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the California Voting Rights Act, that's why civil rights laws, civil liberties laws are so important, right? Because until we're able to socially understand fully and be integrated fully, not assimilated, just integrated
mm-hmm.
In the richness of our diversity, then we're still going to have to engage those conversations because of the historical realities that constructed
And one thing as a history major that shocked me, this has been going on since the beginning. There have been waves of anti-immigration against various groups. We're seeing it again, rearing its ugly head. Keep those immigrants out. Those people are going to, and those people are not just Hispanic anymore. They're Muslims, they're Chinese, or other sorts of groups. We see this, so it's like I get in and I get assimilated or integrated into the community, and then all of a sudden the first thing I want to do is keep everybody else out. Great that you brought us in, but I want to keep the rest of the world in. When Donald Trump says, why do we have so many poor immigrants coming over? Go see the Statue of Liberty. It doesn't say, give me your rich and give me your talented. It says, give me your poor, huddled masses yearning to be free. We'll take everybody who fights to get here and make it. And my point that I said on one of Rod's show earlier, I think this is the conversation that should be had all the time. I'm sorry, I'm pointing at you here. I have a bad habit of doing that. Can America be America if it's not all white and speaking English anymore? That's the underlying fear that my friends in the Midwest feel. If it becomes a Hispanic nation, a Muslim nation, or whatever, it will no longer be America.
Well, I got a newsflash for you. It's not a question that basically you have a choice in.
I got a bigger issue. What makes America exceptional is Republicans like to rant and rave about, and they say Obama doesn't believe in exceptionalism. He's the epitome of exceptionalism. He made it here. Nowhere else could he have done this. He's the poster child for exceptionalism.
Yeah, he could have. There's other places in the world you could have.
Well,
not the only place.
Okay. But this is the example of exceptionalism.
Right.
Okay. A child from nowhere, from nothing, with a Muslim father and an Irish mother, and raised in Indonesia, and somehow he finds his way and makes it to the top.
That story exists in Latin America as well.
Exactly. Does it? Okay, then I don't know that. All right. Having said that, my point is this. We are exceptional because what binds us is not our color or our religion or our tribe. It's an idea in our head. We believe in freedom, we believe in equality, we believe in opportunity. Those three things, if you buy into those three things, and I don't care what religion, if any, who you sleep with at night, what you believe in, what the color of your skin is, where you came from, what your accent is, if you believe in those three principles, then you're an American. And I don't know why we don't push that. That's what an American is. They're not Latino Americans.
So I think you just answered
Americans.
Your own question.
You just answered
your own question. Yes, America can still be America without it having to do with
absolutely.
Color of skin.
If you realize that it's not based on tribalism, it's not based on religion or race or
that's,
language.
That's like what is the historical complexity of contradiction, right? That's hard to reconcile.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the idea that America, that what defines an American is found in our founding documents by the founding fathers.
It's an idea.
That's so named, right? That America is an idea. It's not a race,
yes.
Right? It's not a people.
Maybe the first country and one of the few ever founded on an idea.
But here's the big...
the problem.
Hard to reconcile is those same folks who are writing that not give equality across the board.
No, to women, and so, to African Americans, so anything.
That's where it's tough to get folks to believe in the idea of America because its practice hasn't been its own ideal.
Amen.
Right? And that's so, why...
That's only if, okay, you have a need to have an absolute belief. Okay, and this is what I'm saying, okay?
Don't we all have to have absolute beliefs?
No, absolutely not. Right. Okay,
You're too idealistic.
This is the pragmatic side of me, okay? To expect humanity to act in a manner that may be not discriminatory at some time, to act in a manner that is not out of fear or whatever, basically reactive, is not reality. Okay, we have to accept at the same time that we strive for an ideal, we have to accept what the reality is, because if we don't acknowledge that this is what we're starting with, we will not put in place the tools needed to achieve closeness to that ideal. To look at somebody and say, because you are reacting to me in a seemingly hateful manner today, I'm going to basically then turn around and basically, you know, absolutely dismiss you or not deal with you or feel frightened from you, right, is not to understand that maybe you're coming at it from a position of not knowing. Mm-hmm. And it's my job also to inform you, to provide you an ability to embrace
and to learn
my,
about you as
right.
I want you
yeah.
to learn about
because,
me.
Because otherwise all we do is we perpetuate the same cycle.
Yeah. Can I? Right. That's
where the responsibility of leadership falls. Okay, the person who needs to... When John McCain stood up...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when he was running for president, he stood up and he said to that lady in that conference, right, he said, "No, ma'am, that is not correct, that is not right."
He loves America,
okay?
He's not a Muslim.
When she pointed out and said, well, he is a Muslim, but Barack Obama. When John McCain stood up and did that, okay, he exhibited the form of leadership and expectations that I have of a leadership when faced by a situation like that, doesn't worry about the fact he's going to lose her vote. More so than basically setting the record straight.
As much as I disagree with him and things, he was a hero in that moment. He really was. I'll give you the other example I said on Rod's show here in their last couple minutes. I have my daughter and her significant other, they're not married, whatever, boyfriend, husband, whatever. Live in Santa Ana. They have a wonderful 3-year-old boy now here who's just the light of my life here.
Wow.
And so I go pick him up, and he loves trains. So we go over to the Santa Ana train station. And stand there. And sometimes it's kind of poor in the Santa Ana. There's a lot of homeless people hanging around. I'm always a little concerned about that. But I don't want to feel like a rich white guy walking into a poor neighborhood. But I do feel nervous. And I've got my grandson with me here. And so the other night we were there. It was a couple weeks ago. And it's starting to get dark, which always makes everybody nervous. And train left. There was only 2 people on the platform. Myself. Well, 3. My son, grandson. And a young African-American boy with wild dreadlocks. The wildest look he could get to me is a white guy here, right? And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and both looked around. And he looked scared when he looked at me, and I felt scared. And I was ashamed to say I was scared of this kid standing there in front of me. So I did what I didn't want to do. I didn't run. I went over to him, and I said, "Are you waiting for the next train or whatever?" And it turned out he was scared because he'd never been on a train before, and he'd missed his train. And he didn't know how to read the thing and figure out where to go and all this stuff. So little Jack and I went over and said, "Oh, here, come on over here. Here's where we get the next train," everything. We stopped the next engineer because we waved at the engineers, and they go by, and we said, "Hey, this kid's lost. He needs to get on a thing." Suddenly, this white engineer's like, "Hey, man, okay, come on over here." We got him on the right train, everything. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. I'm trying to say if we would all do that and reach out to each other rather than react out of fear, what a different world we'd have. And how ashamed I was that I looked at him just as a poor black kid. Maybe he's not even poor, but he looks wild and poor to me. I was scared of him.
So we should...
And I'm with my Hispanic grandson.
As I had said in my reading, okay, sounds like a friggin' preacher, but like I said in my reading, is that we have to be leery of those who appeal and poke us and are most sensitive, okay, including ourselves.
Ourselves. I suffer from fear of other groups. I'm not immune to that, but I don't give in.
But it's
try
okay.
Not to
but it's okay
it.
To accept that, Paul. That's what I'm saying. You got to stop beating yourself down for feeling that way, because that's okay. It's what you do with that feeling that's what's important. And that's where the leadership, you know, of somebody like Jose F. Moreno running for city council at District 3, right?
Not that other guy.
Right. But that's where I've always been. Vote for the person versus the party. He's not in my district. He's not anywhere in my city.
The founding fathers did not believe in political parties. They had no anticipation of it. They'd seen them in England, and they hated them.
We need people, okay, that are going to appeal to the better side of us and encourage us to get there.
Our better angels, as Lincoln said.
Right. Versus, basically, which is unfortunately the most common approach to electioneering these days, appeal to the bad side of us and our fears and keep permeating that we have things to be worried and afraid of.
And I think that I know you want to say something, but I got to say this is maybe the long answer to what you were saying. To the extent that people feel you're only serving one person's interest, the Latino community, the white community, the corporate community, whatever, people are going to resist that and say, gee, you're just representing one group of people. To the extent that, and yes, you can be an advocate and voice for whatever group you want to be part of. I'm a rich businessman, or I'm a poor migrant worker, whatever. Somehow we have to, the answer is if they only see, people in the white community react negatively when they hear there are minority groups that are just focused on their interests.
Right.
And that's when they say, gee, you're just focused on Latino kids. We react negatively to that. But on the other hand, if we were honest and say we wouldn't even have to have this conversation if we'd paid more attention to these kids and hadn't ignored them and left them behind and left them alone. So we have to see each other as individuals, as people. I know this sounds just kumbaya and stupid, but to the extent we have to break out of these barriers and get to see each other and experience each other. I hate the fact that the resort they probably have kept it so I don't have to see anybody. We've done homeless discussions on the station here, and somebody said, I don't know how many, there's half a million or something homeless in Orange County. I said, where are they? I never see them. I must be consciously driving around them.
We have an estimated 4,000 children in our schools in Anaheim that are either homeless or in an unstable living environment, in a garage, on the floor. The approximation by the elementary district is that about 70% of the 2,000 kids in the elementary district that are homeless or unstable housing, 70% of those children, their parents actually work. And so that's where we pose the question to city council. You're going to bring in these jobs, many of them part-time, most of them low-income, relatively low income. What's your plan for their housing? And I do think that's where Disney, any industry, does have a responsibility to at least think about, do you know where your employees are going to live? Do you care where they're going to live? They should at least have to answer that question. And whether the council then decides, you know what, you don't have a plan for housing, that's going to put a greater burden on our city resources, then we can't give you $300 million. We're going to need that to build housing.
Right. And the city council actually has a responsibility for zoning for that kind of housing rather than basically finding all kinds of ways to
That's been the corporate argument against Walmart in small towns across America, small white communities across America, is that they come in, pay everybody cheap wages, don't give them health care, and then that puts a burden on the community.
I'm going to do what you usually do.
You're going to cut us off.
Hold on. I'm going to cut us off, but I want to give Jose the last word.
Yes, please.
Again, a teacher gave a shirt to my wife, who's a school principal in West Anaheim, and I'll just leave you with that. Democracy is a verb.
And if you've been listening to the show, you know that it's a messy topic, but you cannot avoid shrugging that responsibility. So I will say this. If you didn't register by yesterday, you're not registered. But please, 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 do not be disenfranchised. Do not be disappointed, despondent. Go out and vote.
Yes.
Okay? It is what
people
really
fought and died for this, this privilege.
People in a lot of places don't have that ability.
No.
Okay, so please engage with your communities, with your elected officials. Demand the leadership that you deserve and go out and vote and let your voice be heard.
Amen to that.
Thanks, Jose, for
being
here.
And continue the conversation. This has been fascinating. I'm sorry to drag it on so long here, but this has been a fascinating exchange. Really.
Thank you both.
I don't get
this. This is a first for us. I actually have to close him down versus him close me down for this.
That's what we do in Anaheim. We're trendsetters.
You are trendsetters.
I like that.
Thank you, Jose.
Thank you both.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.